I heard that Father Sirico was telling jokes and you were laughing. I said, well, that's good, because there's not a joke in this paper. But I hope it will be useful for discussions afterwards. Can you hear me back there? Is this? Yeah, I could take a light. It would help.
Yeah, I don't know. There isn't much light.
That's okay. I hope it will be useful afterwards to help us talk about pastoral theology and some of the problems that you face. So it's, you know that for St. Thomas the virtues are both acquired and infused, and this is an attempt to relate Aquinas' teaching to what the Holy Father teaches in Deus Caritas Est, which is the first encyclical since they began writing them that does not cite St. Thomas Aquinas. Thus my paper. The title of which is straightforward, Aquinas on the Acquired and Infused Moral Virtues. The approach that I take to this classical theme in Catholic moral theology is novel, for I aim to show how what St. Thomas teaches about the two sets of virtues illuminates some central remarks that Pope Benedict XVI makes in his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est. I begin 7 centuries earlier, however, with an event reported to have taken place at the end of the angelic doctor's life. By January of 1274, Thomas Aquinas was in a bad state of health, though he was still preparing to journey by mule toward France, whence Blessed Pope Gregory X had summoned him to attend the Second Council of Lyons in 1274. A little north of the seaside city of Terracina, in the southern part of the Lazio region of Italy, Aquinas stopped at the castle of his niece, Francesca. There he rested from the well-known bump on his head that he received when his mount passed under a low-hanging bough. It was at his niece's home that, in order to satisfy a craving that he had expressed, Aquinas' friar companions obtained from a local fishmonger some fresh herrings. Since in the 13th century these North Sea fish were not ordinarily available south of Paris, this last earthly consolation is thought to have been miraculously provided by the Lord. At the same time, Aquinas' illness worsened. When it became clear to him that he was dying, Aquinas asked to be moved to a religious house so that the Lord would find him in a place that corresponded to his own religious consecration. The Abbazia de Fossanova was close by. It was there that Cistercian monks, who had taken over this monastic establishment in about 1135, time of St. Bernard, received him in their guest house and accompanied him during his final agony. There too Aquinas died in the guest house in the early hours of 7 March 1274. Before his death, however, Aquinas was strong enough to speak edifying words to the monks who came to visit him. There is a tradition that these exchanges took the form of a commentary on the Canticle of Canticles, what today we call the Song of Songs, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Since a commentatorial tradition on this book of the Old Testament forms a staple of Cistercian spirituality, it is not at all surprising that Aquinas would have referred to this Old Testament set of love songs. He was not the last to do so. Pope Benedict XVI cites the Song of Songs in his first encyclical Deus Caritas Est. So we find Aquinas at his death thinking about the great parable of human and divine love that still inspires the Church. Specifically, Pope Benedict XVI explains, and I quote, that the Song of Songs became both in Christian and Jewish literature a source of mystical knowledge and experience, an expression of the essence of biblical faith, that man can indeed enter into union with God, his primordial aspiration, end of quote. The Pope ends his reflection on the Song of Songs with a reference to 1 Corinthians 6:17. He who is united to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. The Holy Father makes the technical but very important point that our union with God occurs without loss of personal identity. This union is no mere fusion, a sinking in the nameless ocean of the divine. The point merits our sustained reflection. Catholic fold is the foundational principle of Christian life, that the more one is united to God through the rhythms of a virtuous life lived in community, the more one discovers his or her own personality. The thought that the Christian life results in the suppression of the complex fabric of human life remains foreign to Catholic doctrine. There is no better way to see this truth displayed with meticulous care than by becoming acquainted with what St. Thomas Aquinas teaches about the infused and acquired virtues. As I have said, what follows aims to suggest that what is taught in Deus Caritas Est coheres with classical Thomas virtue theory, as this doctrine has been expounded in our own day, especially by Dominican Father Sergei Pinkaeus. First of all, allow me to sketch briefly the history of the treatment of the moral virtues in Catholic moral theology, with special emphasis on the presentation of the infused moral virtues. The most significant feature of the history of the moral virtues in Catholic moral thought remains the 400-year eclipse of attention paid to them by moral theologians. In his award-winning book, translated into English as The Sources of Christian Ethics, Father Sergei Pinkaeus provides both the background to and a detailed account of the paradigm change that invades Catholic moral thought in the mid-16th century. This new way of doing moral theology is known as casuistry. Father Pinkaeus reports that the casuist authors abandoned virtue-centered moral theology even as they strove to address certain educational and indeed pastoral issues within the Catholic Church. The eclipse of the virtues and of the corresponding vices, moreover, in Catholic thought coincides with the Catholic reform that followed the Council of Trent, 1554-63, as you recall. For a variety of reasons, the intellectual climate of the early modern period favored law over metaphysics. It's a key critique that Pinkaeus mounts. Casuist moral argument took its inspiration from secular jurisprudence. The approach of the casuist resembled what lawyers do when they prosecute or defend a case in light of applicable laws. That is, moral theologians begin to analyze samples of concrete human conduct, known as cases, thus casuistry, and to assess these cases according to the several moral norms pertinent to the case. Much as legislators legislate within the framework of a constitution, the casuists developed moral opinions about what is permitted and what is forbidden within the framework of divine and ecclesiastical positive laws. The once well-known schools of casuistry, such as probabilism and probabiliarism, emerged inasmuch as four or five groups of approved authors approached doubtful moral questions with varying degrees of, what shall I say, suppleness. Since casuist authors addressed diverse and complex questions, such as what constitutes grave matter in theft, or what may a landlord do when a prostitute wants to rent a room close to the city's cathedral, many doubtful issues emerge. General instruction was given in the classroom and in the pulpit, while more specific and personal guidance was communicated one-on-one in the confessional. In any event, the Catholic faithful were taught moral conclusions that the approved authors had developed in response to model moral dilemmas. It may be surprising to discover that one saintly 17th century casuist afforded this solution to the landlord's dilemma, offered to rent the prostitute another room, but one far removed from the cathedral. Don't laugh, it's St. Alphonsus Liguori. In any case, the governing question for the moral inquirer always took the form of concretizing the permitted and the forbidden. What may I do? What may I not do? Although casuistry represents a clear break with the moral teaching that had been given in the church during roughly the 1500 years that preceded the publication of the first casuist manual, these manuals or handbooks of moral theology began to proliferate from the middle of the 16th century. Father Pinquier's reports that the prototype of the genre was the work by the Spanish Jesuit Juan Azor, who died in 1603, entitled Instituciones Morales. By the 1920s, the short list of approved authors, that is, those whose opinions were judged worthy of consideration, easily included more than 200 names. Even during the sessions of the Second Vatican Council, manuals of casuist moral theology continued to be used in Roman Catholic seminaries, which until the mid-1960s remained the principal venues where moral theology was practiced. Again, it was seminary education with an eye toward preparing priests for confessional practice that motivated and sustained the production of casuist manuals. These textbooks fulfilled the practical requirement that clerics receive clear-cut instruction about what is right and wrong so that they in turn could communicate this knowledge to the lay faithful. In addition to the practical need to save souls, social coherence within the church made the spread of such moral knowledge an urgent task. It's what we call Catholic ethos. Why do I say that casuistry represents an innovation in Catholic moral teaching? To be sure, Catholic moral teachers have always distinguished, in light of divine revelation, between what is right and what is wrong. Doubtful cases arose from the very beginning. Some claim that St. Paul represents the first practitioner of casuistry when he counsels the Corinthians about eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols, 1 Corinthians 8, 1-13. On the other hand, there remains the unquestionable fact that once moral theology began to develop as a distinct discipline, the moral virtues emerged as the preferred way to instruct people in the manner of Christian loving. That is, the fathers and the monks and the schoolmen taught their flock, their disciples, or their students those qualities of character that a disciple of Christ should develop and maintain in order to fulfill the double commandments of love. Appeal to Aristotle's notion of habitus provided some of them with a way to explain the transformative nature of virtue, and at the same time helped them to emphasize that divine grace is not performative only. Appeal to Aristotle's notion of habitus provided some of them with a way to explain the transformative nature of virtue, and at the same time helped them to emphasize that divine grace is not performative only. The whole tradition agrees on this point, that the new life given to the Christian is not limited to doing good with the extrinsic help of God. Easter, this is clear. The writings that we conserve from these periods, patristic, monastic, and scholastic, bear abundant witness to the place that virtue holds in the long tradition of Christian moral teaching, even if it is true that before the 12th century, Christian authors largely assumed that an authentically virtuous life remains a specific property of justification by Catholic faith and baptism. For many reasons, early Christian moralists were wont to assume, that the only virtue worth talking about is Christian virtue. The most comprehensive witness to the Christian virtue tradition is found in the Secunda Pars of the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas. Recall that Aquinas' genius lies not only in his analytical skills, but also in his capacity to recapitulate the received tradition from the fathers, the monastic authors, and the earlier schoolmen, especially Peter Lombard. In the Secunda Pars, we find a description of the Christian life comprised of 170 questions that deal with, quote, the particular virtues and the vices which relate to all humans generally and in every condition and walk of life. Let me recommend an easy way to discover what Aquinas accomplishes in the Secunda Pars if you don't have time to read the 170 questions. Michael Dauphiné and Matthew Levering provide a short but comprehensive account of what Aquinas treats in the second part of his Summa in their book Knowing the Love of Christ, published out of Notre Dame, in chapter 3 especially. The authors entitled this chapter Happiness and Virtue. They remind us that the specification of the virtues of the Christian life is not the product of vivid moral imaginations, the moral equivalent, so to speak, of griffins or manticores or other mythical animals that inhabit only the medieval bestiary. On the contrary, the virtues and virtuous activity are measured by what perfects human creatures, by what makes each human being happy. Human nature sets the measure for virtuous human behavior. This view of morality is called teleological. I think I spoke about it here the last time. A good summary of a teleological account of moral action and of the life that it sustains is found in the 1993 encyclical letter of Pope John Paul II, Veritatis Splendor, at numbers 71 to 83. One sentence is especially helpful to see the relationship between good, that is, virtuous human behavior, and anthropology. I quote the encyclical, "Activity is morally good," the Pope says, "when it attests to and expresses the voluntary ordering of the person to his ultimate end and the conformity of a concrete action with the human good as it is acknowledged in its truth by reason." That's number 72. When we contemplated that sentence and absorbed the teaching, then we're ready to be good moral guides. Moral theology, then, is about promoting the true good of the human person. This important encyclical, Veritatis Splendor, especially in the technical discussions in Chapter 2, draws heavily, as you know, upon the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. It also includes references to the virtues of the Christian life, especially at number 64. This is perhaps the influence of Father Pinkers on the encyclical. Who knows? Sounds like him. It is the heart, converted to the Lord and to the love of what is good, which is really the source of true judgments of conscience. Indeed, in order to prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect, knowledge of God's law in general is certainly necessary, but it is not sufficient. What is essential is a sort of connaturality between man and the true good. And the reference is to Aquinas' Secundus Secundae 45:2. Such a connaturality is rooted in and develops through the virtuous attitudes of the individual himself. Prudence and the other cardinal virtues, and even before these, the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. This is the meaning of Jesus' saying, "He who does what is true comes to the light." End of quote. The reference to connaturality is one that suggests both the deep-seated affinity that the human creature can develop for observing the truth of God's law and the indispensability of virtue for perfecting this observance. The encyclical cites Thomas Aquinas as the principal source for this important teaching on connaturality, and thus at least indirectly points to his teaching on the nature and importance of virtuous habitus. During the four centuries that preceded the opening of the Second Vatican Council in 1962, happiness and virtue and the connaturality that unites them were not the themes that dominated Catholic moral teaching. Moral teachers, of course, spoke about eternal happiness, but not as an end or object that shapes concrete human conduct and which can be experienced, at least in some measure, here and now by those who live a virtuous life. They rather spoke about eternal happiness as a future reward for right conduct. Moral teachers also wrote about the virtues, but not as the preferred way to describe the requirements of the everyday moral life, and at the same time to teach non-specialists how to appreciate virtue's connaturality. They rather left the development of virtues to professionally religious persons who, because of the vows they pronounced, were understood to have committed themselves to the acquisition of habits of perfection over and above what keeping the commandments requires. In effect, then, the Christian virtues, or so it was thought, were of interest only to a restricted group of people. Instead of presenting the virtues with full attention paid to their unity and interconnectedness, casuistry organized its moral teaching around the triangular structure of conscience, freedom, and moral law. Undergirding this structure, the casuist authors and their clerical exponents relied on the notion or the sentiment of moral obligation. You will find a succinct and helpful account of this history in Father Pinkers' abridged version of his sources, published in English as Morality, the Catholic View, especially in Chapter 4, where he speaks about the manuals of moral theology. Father Pinkers insightfully describes the casuist outlook as promoting moralities of obligation. To evaluate the potential effectiveness of this approach, one needs only to recall the reluctance that our contemporaries exhibit toward Catholic moral teaching. I'd say significant reluctance. It is worth asking how much an outmoded casuist view of moral obligation continues to dominate, albeit adversely, the outlook of modern Catholics. Today, when a parent, a priest, or a teacher attempts to impose a complex network of moral obligations on children, parishioners, or students, the result is predictable for the most part. Such an effort, by and large, draws a response of skepticism or rebellion, especially given the widely held view that one should measure the exercise of freedom precisely in relationship to the range of options that remain open to a person. Obligation and responsibility remain legitimate moral categories. When, however, they are made to stand alone, these notions fail to sustain the full range of Christian moral teaching. Within a very short period after the close of the Second Vatican Council in 1965, the practitioners of casuistry found themselves out of work. The symbolic date is 1968, the year in the second half of the 20th century that witnessed so much rebellion against both civil and moral authority. The highly public rejection of Pope Paul VI's encyclical letter Humanae Vitae, which reaffirmed what the Church had always taught about the sinfulness of sterilizing the procreative act, marks a turning point in the history of Catholic moral teaching and practice. 25 years between 1968 and 1993, the year Veritas et Splendor was issued, represents a period when sound Catholic moral teaching found expression among a limited number of authors, several of them laymen. The subsequent reception of Veritas et Splendor has not yet been studied, although the present apostolic visitation of seminaries in the United States may result in giving some indication of how much this magisterial document has influenced the teaching of Catholic moral doctrine. During the 400-year casuist eclipse of virtue-centered moral theology, discussion about the infused and acquired virtues occupied the attention of two kinds of theologians. The first group was ascetical or mystical theologians, such as Sulpician Father Adolf Alfred Tanqueray, who died in 1932, and whose book, The Spiritual Life, A Treatise on Ascetical and Mystical Theology, was widely used by religious and in seminaries. Or to cite another example, the French Dominican, of course, Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, died in 1964, whose treatises on the spiritual life featured discussions of the virtues. The second group comprised a small number of Thomist theologians who, although they accepted the casuist model regnant in the church of their period, maintained an interest in the virtues as part of their exegetical interest in the text of St. Thomas Aquinas. Two examples are the German Dominican, Dominic Primer, who published in 1923 his three-volume Manuale Theologiae Moralis, and the less well-known Provençal Dominican, Marie-Michel Labaudet, who died just in 1990, whose articles and class notes on moral theology formed several generations of 20th century French Dominicans and others. I myself owe a debt of gratitude to Father Labaudet for the book that the University of Notre Dame published in 1991, The Moral Virtues and Theological Ethics, where I discuss the acquired and infused virtues. It's still in print, and I say this not to draw attention to myself, but to let you know it's still a hot topic. Even Notre Dame is talking about a second revised edition. This lecture will be part of the introductory chapter. What is an infused virtue? The first thing to remember about an infused virtue is that it comes from God as a free gift. This means that knowledge of infused virtue forms part of a theological instruction that depends upon the communication of divine revelation. In a small work devoted to the place that the virtues hold in the Christian life, that's entitled The Disputed Questions on the Virtues, St. Thomas Aquinas replies to those who would question whether God infuses specific moral habitus by referring to texts from both the Old and New Testaments. I cite them. First, it's said contra. On the contrary, it is said in Luke 24:49, but wait here in the city until you are clothed with power from on high. Moreover, in Wisdom 8:7, speaking of divine wisdom, the author says, for she teaches temperance and prudence and justice and fortitude by causing them. Therefore, it seems that there are moral virtues, Aquinas concludes, infused in us by God. Note that Aquinas argues that the infused virtues represent legitimate examples of the divine beneficence, and that, like the cardinal virtues of Aristotle, are helpful to explain how God's grace informs our lives. If you will, they're Pentecost graces. The theological meaning of the two texts cited by Aquinas in the above said cantor is clear. Christ promises his disciples and through them his church that the power of the Holy Spirit, a divine power, will be bestowed efficaciously on them so that they can fulfill their Christian vocations. In the Old Testament, this divine power is identified as the divine wisdom, an act of principle in creation, which according to the Book of Wisdom is the source of everything that man needs to pursue a complete human life. As Pope Benedict reminds us in the encyclical, quote, the ancient world had dimly perceived that man's real food, what truly nourishes him as man, is ultimately the Logos, eternal wisdom. Leave it to the exegetes to explain how the very virtues that Aristotle enumerates in his Nicomachean Ethics find their way into an inspired text of the Old Testament. It really makes no difference. These philosophical concepts lose nothing of their truth once they are transposed into a divine instruction, a sacra doctrina, if you will. As one author explains in another context, the aphorisms of Proverbs lose nothing of their native salt when they are taken into a sacra lectio. It's God's divine revelation, God using human means to communicate divine truth. The conclusion follows that one way to differentiate the gift of helping grace promised to Christians is to appeal to the natural or acquired virtues and to assume, therefore, that these human virtues are able to exist independent from Christian grace. The late German philosopher Joseph Pieper, to cite one example, has left us a lucid account of the acquired cardinal virtues based only on philosophical reflection. Aquinas' appeal to the virtues of the philosophers is revolutionary. Church fathers such as St. Ambrose and St. Augustine acknowledge the moral virtues, but as I have already mentioned, we'll want to consider them as so many different instantiations, examples, if you will, of divine charity, and so available only to those who abide in God's love. Now note that no Catholic is free to dispute that God gives grace to enable us to pursue virtuous action. The Catechism of the Catholic Church makes this clear. Christ's gift of salvation offers us the grace necessary to persevere in the pursuit of the virtues. Everyone should ask for this grace of light and strength, frequent the sacraments, cooperate with the Holy Spirit, and follow his calls to love what is good and shun evil. What remains a matter of theological discussion is whether, without the gift of salvation, natural virtue is possible for man in the present state of human existence. In a word, Aquinas holds that the pursuit of virtue is possible, although his interpreters offer a range of views that stretch from cautiously optimistic to cautiously pessimistic about any individual realizing natural virtue without the help of divine grace. This question about the realizability of virtue is discussed by Catholic theologians under the heading of man's need for grace in order to live a good life and to receive the reward of everlasting life. This question, however, is not the same as inquiring about the distinction between the acquired and infused virtues. At the same time, correct understanding of how acquired and infused virtues work together provides a useful source of reflection for arriving at a correct answer to the question, what human good can a person achieve without the help of divine grace? Aquinas builds his teaching about the two sets of virtues upon the claim that two ends or perfections remain available to the human creature. One is a natural end or perfection that corresponds to the natural capacities that are native to the human person. The other is a supernatural end or perfection that is possible only because of a special gift of divine grace given through Christ. One end belongs to the order of nature, whereas the other belongs to the order of supernature. Only in the latter order is the human person drawn into the circle of benevolent love that the New Testament calls charity. In his encyclical, Pope Benedict XVI stresses this point when he warns us to be wary of, quote, establishing a clear antithesis between human love and divine love, agape. I quote, number 7. In philosophical and theological debate, these distinctions have often been radicalized to the point of establishing a clear antithesis between them, descending oblative love, agape, would be typically Christian, while on the other hand, ascending, possessive, or covetous love, eros, would be typical of non-Christian, particularly Greek culture. That, by the way, was the position of Andres Nijman, it's the Protestant position. Were this antithesis to be taken to extremes, the essence of Christianity would be detached from the vital reflections fundamental to human existence. Read that again. Were this antithesis to be taken to extremes, the essence of Christianity would be detached from the vital relations fundamental to human existence and would become a world apart. Admirable, perhaps, think of von Balthasar, but decisively cut off from the complex fabric of human life. That was an editorial remark about von Balthasar. The categories that the Pope employs are taken from the language of the biblical authors and early theologians. You need to edit that out. Okay. However, he makes the same point that Aquinas does when he affirms that there exist two ends for human life. These natural and supernatural destinies require unification, though without destroying human nature, that is, without being decisively cut off from the complex fabric of human life. That's the stuff of the virtues, everything from food, drink, and sex all the way up to how to govern a world order. The twofold end of human existence governs the way that Aquinas presents the need for two sets of virtues. His summary exposition in question 63, article 3 of the Prima Secunda sets up the relationship as he envisages it. I quote, effects should be proportioned to their causes and principles. Now, all virtues, intellectual and moral, acquired by our actions, arise from certain natural principles pre-existing in us, as he explained earlier in the Prima Secunda. In other words, Aquinas acknowledges that what some have called the virtues of the philosophers correspond to potentialities in the human being. These habitus of action enable the human person to know and to accomplish what is necessary in order to attain a happy life. Aristotle, for one, was confident that a certain number of select males were able to achieve, without divine intervention, this goal that he called contemplation. Aquinas, of course, assents in faith to the divine intervention that we call the incarnation and to its promise of the universal call to holiness. So he goes on to add, parallel to these natural principles, God bestows on us the theological virtues by which we are directed to a supernatural end, as he earlier discusses in the Prima Secunda. And so there should be other habitus divinely caused in us, corresponding in due proportion to the theological virtues, which habitus are to them what the moral and intellectual virtues are to the natural principles of the virtues. These other habitus are what the Catholic tradition calls the infused virtues. This is grace building on nature. Infused moral virtues are to be distinguished from the theological virtues. The theological virtues refer to those distinctively Christian virtues that characterize human persons who are baptized and who maintain the grace of their baptism by living a virtuous life. They are traditionally called faith, hope, and charity. Faith supplies the perfection of the intellect inasmuch as through it we ascend to divinely revealed truths. Hope adorns the will or rational appetite inasmuch as it strengthens our expectation for the gift of everlasting life and steadies us against the temptation to despair of it or to presume on receiving it willy-nilly. Charity is both mother and crown of the virtues, a sharing in the very inner reality of God that distinctively makes of the Christian a participant in the fellowship of divine friendship that we call heaven. This blessed fellowship here below is anticipated and realized in the mystery of the church. The theological virtues are called theological, not to suggest that theologians eminently possess them, as should be abundantly clear, but to remind us that these virtues in diverse ways unite us immediately to God. In the language of Aquinas, they have God as their object, first truth and highest goodness. Aquinas contends that while the theological virtues transform the human person into an adopted son or daughter of God, this very state of adoptive sonship, expressed so in order to emphasize the Christian's relation to Christ, requires another set of virtues that shape the operative capacities of the human person so that one may fulfill the concrete commands of the great commandment of love. As Benedict XVI reminds us, love of God and love of neighbor have become one. In the least of the brethren, we find Jesus himself, and in Jesus we find God. To complete this task, one requires the infused virtues that have God as both source and completion. No wonder Aquinas makes a point of affirming that the acts of acquired virtue can only be meritorious by the mediation of the infused virtues. In the least of the brethren, we find Jesus himself, and in Jesus we find God. The good actions that proceed from cardinal prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance take on saving significance only insofar as they are elevated to participate in the saving work of Jesus Christ. In the least of the brethren, we find Jesus himself, and in Jesus we find God. As the Catechism of the Catholic Church neatly puts it, the charity of Christ is the source in us of all our meriting before God. In the least of the brethren, we find Jesus himself, and in Jesus we find God. The word infusion points to the origin of the infused virtues from a source outside of the human person. They are gift. With respect to its cause, a supernatural virtue is said to be infused. With respect to its subject, however, us, to be educed, brought out of us. Potentiality in a real subject exists in two forms. The first is the ability or capacity to act. It's a potentiality until I do it. I'm talking. Thus the will chooses. The mouth speaks. Whereas the second is the capacity to be acted on. Thus a receptivity that goes with the active power of the human person. The ancient philosophers refer then to axio and passio. The second potentiality to be acted upon, the sun burns me, is subject to two influences, one from the forces of a being's own immediate environment and one from a higher force. My own immediate environment, no sunscreen. The higher force, the sun. Infused virtue then represents both a gift from above and a perfection of human nature. Of course, it is not natural for the human creature to operate with the additional resources that God gives graciously through the merits of Jesus Christ and the sacraments of the Church. The infused virtues, as St. Thomas suggests by citing Luke 24:49, text we heard earlier, represent true Pentecost graces, real gifts from the Holy Spirit that abide among Christian believers as their special prerogatives. They do not, in other words, fall into the category of theoretical illusions. At the same time, they shape us, really. They meet up within us something that, if you will, the grace recognizes, so that the perfection that comes from the infused virtues is something that we are familiar with, such as loving, in the least of the brethren, Jesus. The infused virtues accomplish an objective that is different from that of the acquired virtues. They order us to share a fellow citizenship with the saints in heaven. And because the infused virtues originate from a divine source and point us toward a divine destiny, they observe a rule or measure that is specific to the demands of the Christian gospel. St. Thomas makes this point clearly in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae 63, Article 4. quote, "For instance, in eating, the measure fixed by human reason is that food should not harm the health of the body nor hinder the use of reason. Whereas the measure fixed by divine law requires that a man should chastise his body and bring it into subjection by abstinence and food, drink, and the like." Aquinas goes on to conclude, "It is therefore evident that infused and acquired temperance differ in kind, that is, they are two different species of virtues. It's all the difference between philanthropy and charity," what the Pope expresses in the second part of the encyclical. Texts such as Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae 63.4 help to explain why the Thomist tradition pauses before the alternative explanation of the Christian virtues, which rejects the existence of the infused virtues and accounts for properly Christian behavior by extrinsically associating the theological virtues with the acquired virtues. In this alternative proposal, one espoused by Francis de Sales, and therefore with a certain currency in Catholic practice, where you see it, by the way, is in Father John Harvey in the Courage Program, faith becomes a source of knowledge for discovering a divine rule or measure, and charity becomes the motive cause to observe it. This conception leaves the acquired virtues touched only from the outside, as it were, by divine grace. For his part, Aquinas holds out for a bolder and more reassuring explanation. Divine grace creates a new virtue. Thus, the infused virtues actually produce our actions by shaping the proximate sources of these actions in the human person, what the scholastics call the operative powers or capacities. These include both intellect and will, thus the infused virtues of prudence and justice. A special feature of Aquinas' view on the infused moral virtues is that the virtues of the sense appetites, of personal discipline, temperance, and fortitude, shape the sense powers of the human soul. The characteristic of virtuous activity is that it proceeds from within us promptly, joyfully, and easily. This claim seems difficult to sustain in the face of common human experience, especially when it comes to the sense appetites, what we may speak of broadly as the emotions. I refer to the movements that rise up in us when we find ourselves attracted to a perceived sense good, God or the girl, or repelled from what is perceived as harmful. Aquinas is a realist. He entertains the objection that many who have charity, listen carefully to this, it's consoling, especially when you get older. Many who have charity and are free from mortal sin nonetheless have difficulty performing acts of virtue, nor do they find these acts pleasing for their own sakes, but only for the sake of charity. This observation applies to all the virtues, but especially those that seek to put reason and emotion. We find ourselves back to the central theme of agape in Christian moral teaching. Pope Benedict XVI reminds us, I quote, "It is from there, the pierced side of Christ, that our definition of love must begin." In this contemplation, the Christian discovers the path along which his life and love must move. To make a long exegesis short, Aquinas would identify this discovery, the path along which his life and love must move, with the discovery of the infused virtues, the infused moral virtues. Aquinas is a moral realist in two senses of the term. He recognizes that the moral good participates in being like other good things that exist in the world. He also is a realist because he takes full account of the state of man after the fall, the post-lapsarian human creature. Listen to what he says. "There always remains the struggle," the Latin is coluptatio, "between the flesh and the spirit, tug and pull. Even with moral virtue." The apostle speaks of this in Galatians 5:17, where he states, "For flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh." Does this struggle, or coluptatio, contradict what he teaches about the gifts of grace that we call infused moral virtues? By no means. Infused virtues create a different kind of promptness, ease, and joy in the Christian believer than what is produced by the acquired virtues. This distinction forms the basis for Aquinas' whole spirituality. It is best expressed in his disputed question on the virtues. I quote, acquired virtue prevails in this, that the struggle is felt less. And this is due to how this type of virtue is caused, which is by repeated acts. For one loses the custom of obeying such passions when one becomes accustomed to resisting them, and that is why one is troubled by them less. Think of putting your socks on in the morning. It's not a big struggle. But infused virtue prevails in this, that although such passions are felt, think of anything else you want, they in no way dominate, for infused virtue brings it about that the concupiscence of sin is in no way obeyed. And as long as infused virtue remains, it does this, most important word, infallibly. There is no question that this description of the virtuous person remains foreign to our contemporaries, including many of our fellow priests. The challenge for the student who wants to study the moral theology of St. Thomas Aquinas is to contribute to the restoration of virtue in Catholic moral thought. The best way to proceed in this undertaking is to begin to live according to the rhythms of the infused virtues. This means living a life of love that finds its origin in our contemplation of the incarnate Son, from whose pierced side flows everything that we need to sustain what Pope Benedict XVI calls a sacramental mysticism. Although the Holy Father uses a language different than that of the Thomas tradition, he captures what Aquinas expresses in his complete treatment of the infused virtues. And I end with a quote from the Pope. Faith, worship, and ethos are interwoven as a single reality which takes shape in our encounter with God's agape. Thank you. That was all very theoretical, I recognize, and so, but that doesn't mean that our discussion of questions cannot, to the best that I'm able to help, address more practical concerns, all of which in one way there's no moral question we didn't touch upon at a certain level. Yeah, Father Carlos.
Is there a charity as a infused virtue as opposed to charity as a theological virtue?
Well, okay, The theological are only infused. There are no human, there are no acquired analogs to faith, hope, and charity. Suarez thought there was acquired faith. You know, some of the Jesuits thought they had.
You said charity was only for the baptized.
That's true. Well, as far as we know.
But in Deus Caritas, is there some parallel virtue, infused virtue, that would correspond to charity?
Well, that's what agape is. Infuse, remember, talks about how it is that we receive it. So infused, if we want to take another way of expressing it, is infused virtue is associated with divine grace, habitual grace, justification, and therefore is gift, if you want. And without the gift, without the justification, without the habitual grace, and without the charity, there are no other infused virtues. Now, the theological virtues for which there are no acquired counterparts come only through prevenient grace.
So is Pope Benedict proposing baptism for everyone? Would that be?
Well, that's another issue. That's the question of... I think he's just taking the catechism. As far as we know, the only way in which divine grace is communicated is that the Church knows no other way in which justification is communicated other than through baptism. She knows no other way. Whether God knows, that's another question. But one thing is for sure, what is being said, in terms of what he's talking about, implicit in this is an Augustinian restrictionist document. He starts off by saying God in our age is being used not for negative reasons, but even for violence. I mean, it's like, and that is, he tells you that this is not, God cannot be used to justify violence. But that's, I mean, the question, no, all right, I mean, that, the question of who is the beneficiary, the answer is those whom God has called, those whom God has justified, and those who maintain the grace of justification, whether through the sacrament of reconciliation or an initial justification by baptism. But mortal sin kills all of this, if that's what you're asking. Yes, mortal sin does kill this, because you can't be going north and south at the same time. And so you can't be saying, I'm loving God, I'm going to see Jesus in my neighbor, and I'm going to keep my mistress on the side. It doesn't. So mortal sin, where mortal sin, I mean, I mentioned it in there obliquely when I mentioned the moral act. It kills all of this. And it certainly removes you from the circle of agape. Yeah.
I was just wondering, this eros and agape, is Benedict drawing upon the writings of some other saint who discussed this in the past, the idea that agape is kind of the telos or the end of eros? Did Augustine work on this, or Bonaventure, or?
No, I think he tells you. I mean, it's classical. Originally, it's classical Greek thought, although in which the agape doesn't have a very large place because they didn't think it was worth talking about. The eros became ecstatic in religion. He talks about the Vestal Virgins who weren't.
You have that idea of moving towards the eros as a telos into agape? Would that be something novel for Greek thought?
No, well, no, it depends. That's what I mean. All right, what I say, all right, fine. What, you know, Aristotle found what would be called the equivalent of an agapeic love in contemplation at the end of the Nicomachean Ethics. And Plato found it in Justice and the World of the Forms.
But those would be acquired virtues.
Well,
so, we would, in Aristotle. The way he is.
Oh, no, he's asking the question about where the Pope is drawing. Yeah, I mean, if you're asking me where does this come from in the Holy Father, as far as I'm able to determine. Now, I mean, more approximately, where this comes from is Andras Nigrin. The unseen interlocutor here is Andras Nigrin, whom the younger fathers know you, and therefore you never heard about Father Cecilius speak. Well, roughly in the late four, around World War II, Anders Nygren was the Lutheran bishop of Stockholm, I believe, or certainly somewhere in Sweden, and he was, as the custom of Swedish Lutheran bishops it had been, like the fellow that was here at Harvard, what was his name, Christel Stendahl, was an intellectual, and he wrote a long, thick book defending the Protestant principle of sola gratia, sola scriptura, and sola fides. And in the Protestant construal of things, the only think of Kierkegaard if you want. I mean, think of Martin, think of anybody. The only thing that's worth talking about is grace, translate agape. And when the Pope says, the contrast between this is the dissociation of nature and grace. It was the whole reason, by the way, in the 19th century that Leo XIII, among other factors that compelled him, recognized that the value of St. Thomas in talking about grace perfecting nature was a very effective way of dealing with the Protestant claims that true religion was only a world of grace. In our day, you'd think of Bultmann. Think of Bultmann if you want to find an equivalent who's not who also talks about the morality. In other words, where the only thing that matters is the Easter faith. You know, everything else. Not even Christ, not even the historical Jesus matters anymore. It's only the... So against that separation, which the Pope, that's why he says, though admirable, you can paint a beautiful picture. I said von Balthasar, I succumbed to temptation and said von Balthasar. You can paint beautiful pictures, you see. But if I can't insert myself into it in some way that is recognizable, then that beautiful picture, no matter how edifying and beautiful it may be, is going to fall short of realizing the gospel. Which, I mean, you can see it, for example, in the way in which liberal Protestantism segues so easily into philanthropy. It's the very thing he says at the end, don't let the churches caritative works. I like the adjectival form of as caritative. It was a 17th century term that exists, but sometimes you've got to go back to get it, you know. Because otherwise, there's no other way of talking about it in English, because we only have love, you know, we don't have the... So as far as approximately in ancient times, he's talking about the Greeks, but more in terms of but it's hidden because he's not anti-ecumenical, you know. Mm-hmm. But more approximately, it's Anders Nygren and the Protestant construal of another world only. There's one last thing to help. I mean, you can see it, for example, where does it impinge today? In the charismatic, Protestant charismatic about the final coming and the secret rapture and all of that. Okay, Father and then Father and then Father. Triangle. 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Well, no, this behind you is Michael.
I frequently have, you know, moral problems that present to me in the conventional or outside or something, and I get a lot of insight from some of those old manuals. Sometimes that's the only place I can find, you know, some guidance to it. I have read Thomas's treatise on the virtues of Summa, but I mean, is there a problem with me going to a manual if I can find a real direct?
Well, not as long as you don't get drawn in to the methodology of the manuals that I described. And I mean, if you want discrete, I mean, to consult, to look at it as consultation for discrete issues. So, for example, the different ways in which the casuists argued for what constitutes grave matter, which, by the way, requires restitution or not. It's an important thing. You know, bless me if I have sinned. I took something. What'd you take? Well, okay, you know, $50 worth of, you know, products here or something there. One thing, you know, embezzled my company out of $1,000, $2,000. I mean, restitution kicks in and you get another whole set of questions about occult restitution, deferred and so forth. So there are questions that it can be usefully consulted on. But it's the method that is incompatible with Veritatis Splendor. And you can't go back because, I mean, it relies on an ethos which simply has disappeared from the secular world, which is called moral sentiment. You just don't have it. Now, you can go out and try to build it up, but pretty soon what are you going to have to say? You're going to have to say, saying, if you don't do this, you're going to go to hell. It's because that's the only way you're going to generate moral sentiments. Well, I mean, of any religious value. You know, you can do it conscience wise. And if it works, fine. Don't let me say anything that works. Go do it. You're going to discover it doesn't work because hidden in the Kantian morality is a cultural setting that simply, you know, is Prussia, which is not Western civilization today. So I think Pinkers's books, I mean, it's useful to see the critique, and then you can go to, but you got to also be careful with the manualists because, you know, you had a range from Laxus to Tutsiris, so you don't want to go to the wrong manualists. Probabiliarist manualists you might find useful. That was us, the Dominicans.
The first point in the catechism seems to be Kapok Stay, the human person as oriented to a supernatural end. How does that fit? I mean, it seems to be saying the very structure of the person. It's the first, it's the topic of the first section.
Right, but Kapok Stay.
Kapok.
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, I mean, on these matters, there are certain limits. You can't make man so ordered to God that God is cruel and not fulfilling a natural requirement, and you can't make man so indisposed to God that the arrival of grace seems like something which is a tremendous upheaval and reversal in your life. Somewhere between those two extremes, you have a certain latitude. But the catechism does, it is correct, begin with the anthropological and Augustinian premise, thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. And that's fine. What else is the catechism going to say? But it does not, and cannot, and would not, and may not say that beatitude is something that is required for the intelligibility of human nature.
No.
Because you see, the scripture and the church knows of faith outside of baptism, and that is in Abraham. And so it seems to be an example of infused theological virtue outside of baptism. No?
No. I mean, St. Thomas, because Abraham's faith is of something forward. It's Christus passus est. He's going to suffer. Our faith is Christus passus est. He has suffered. I mean, so we have, when we talk about the faith of our father Abraham, or the ecclesia of Abel, this is the affirmation of the two covenants, the unity of the two covenants. You have to do that. You can't be Martian. You can't say the Old Testament was a big mistake, or we have to cut it up like Thomas Jefferson cut up the New Testament to fit Catholic principles. So the unity of the two testaments is one thing, and the unity of faith in the two testaments, because Christ is the Lord of all, and he fulfills that promise to the chosen people in the harrowing of hell, Holy Saturday. There von Balthasar, draws our attention. But as the hell of the just indicates, it's only when Christ dies on the cross that the Pope says, it's from the pure side of Christ that the theological life, if you will, flows.
Well, how can St. Paul use the faith of Abraham as an example for our faith?
Well, because he's talking to the Jews to try to show the continuity. He's trying to plead with them of the continuity.
He's not talking to Jews, he's talking to us.
Well, in the text where he draws the cogency of the argument is because of trying to show that the gospel is a fulfillment of the promise. That before, you can't, otherwise you compromise, you can't compromise the efficacy of the cross.
Well, no, but yeah. I mean, that's what God does, but what we do is respond in faith, and it seems as though St. Paul is telling us, we'll look at Abraham and respond like him. I mean, I'm sure that's what St. Paul is telling us.
Well, he is.
I'm not questioning what Christ does, and Christ, obviously, I'm questioning what we are to do, our part of faith, what God allowed Abraham to do.
Yeah. Well, the structure of the faith is imitable because Abraham believes God's word even when put to the test, as we read in the Easter Vigil. But what is different between the faith of Abraham and the faith of the baptized is what it achieves. The faith of the baptized achieves justification, and the justification that introduces the person into the communion of divine fellowship we call heaven or beatific vision or whatever. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David and Solomon, and you can go on, were not introduced. And the witness to this is clearly represented in every cathedral in Europe and in Byzantine icons galore, where in the triumphal procession that comes, and Fra Angelico picked it up, on Holy Saturday, the risen Christ first of all leads out Adam and Eve, and behind is Abraham, Isaac, David. You can see him, he's got his harp. They made no mistake about it. They're all let out, Sarah, the whole crowd of them. And those are the patres. Those are the holy ones of the Old Testament, whom we can venerate as saints. And can, you know, that's why you can name Christian children Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And there are churches in the East and also in Venice, because of the Eastern practice, to venerate the saints of the Old Testament. The number, it is suggested, I should point out to you, is limited. We don't know, but you know, there's no wide claim. That's why it's a genealogy. The people that make it are pretty much the ones you read about, which is not the universal call to holiness. So that's what St. Thomas means when he says the faith of Abraham could only be in a Christus posturus, that he believed that Christ would suffer, and that gives unity. But it's not the same tense, and the tense is what's important, because it's the past tense that in the line of causal efficacy counts.
Strikes me that one of the immediate pastoral applications of your theme provenance of the infused virtues, that the sacramental life of the church's charitable agents is probably going to be a priority, even higher than obvious other things like solid catechesis. Would that be your take on it as well?
Run that by me again, Roger. Okay.
If charity being an infused virtue right. comes from this encounter with Christ, grace, etc., that in our application of what Benedict is asking us to do to form the hearts of the church's charitable agents, that would probably be our number one priority, even beyond...
It's not just charity. See, it's not just charity. What I'm trying to show is that... If you just go to take the Catholic Charities of Boston, just to take an example that happens to be on my mind, and you would go up and start talking about charity. See, that's Andres Nagy. If you just start talking about charity, they're going to give you 10,000 reasons why they're doing the loving thing. You know that. I don't have to. Everybody there knows this. You don't have to elaborate. When it comes to adopting gay children, or when it comes to doing God knows what else they do. And the same argument is going to be made in hospitals. The same argument is going to be made with this is the loving thing. This is the equivocation of love. Now, that's why you need the infused moral virtues. And that's what I'm trying to suggest. If you want to go up and say, why shouldn't Catholic agencies confide children to gay couples? Well, this hasn't been done. Nobody's done it. But it's not just enough to talk about agape. What you have to do is talk about marriage and family and rearing of children and a whole work of demonstration, which is very difficult to achieve, I hasten to add. However, when you do it, you'll be talking about infused justice, specifically filial piety, which is part of justice, which is the kind of reverence that parents owe to children and children owe to parents. And you should be able to show that sodomizing couples are not showing demonstrative filial piety if in fact they constitute what would constitute scandal.
Because of the source, the font of the infused virtues, meaning God, to make the question a little bit simpler, the relationship between the sacraments and the graces given through the sacraments and the formation of the heart of the church's pastoral agents and caritative agents would strike me as pretty strong.
What I've seen
with a lot of the church's pastoral agents is that the sacramental life sometimes because they're
divorced
are doing such good work for the church after all.
The reason why this, you have to remember, we have to learn from our past mistakes. Why are so many, perhaps this is unfamiliar to many, I think the older fathers might have heard it, but might have been unfamiliar to many of you. It certainly wasn't taught in the moral theology if you learned it between 68 and 93, anywhere, including most major seminaries. So, but you have to take the man that put the death knell to this was Kamarana, both because of the supernatural existential, but also because of what he called the mechanic, the sacramental mechanism, the reification of sacramental grace. So I agree with you, but I would like to combine, and I'd like to win the next round, if possible. And I don't want to win it, I want you to win it, because you're the people that are on the front lines. And you're also young, so there's going to be more battles. But so we should learn from what happened the last time and not fall into the trap, which that would be a book to explain. But one way out of the trap is to emphasize, he talks about sacramental mysticism. You notice he's gingerly. Now, I think that's a good phrase, sacramental mysticism. Because really what he means is, if you want to be immersed in God, okay, then receiving everything that you need to live, not just faith, hope, charity, but prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. And I didn't get to the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which we could add to those. Then that kind of life is inconceivable apart from a full sacramental life, from baptism to holy anointing, with the Eucharist at the center and penance exactly, and holy and confession and penance before, and the rest that you all know about. So yes, but I would prefer, see the thing about the infused virtues is that they really flow from a right understanding of justification and the divine indwelling, and I'd rather move there. Because then you protect yourself from some of the facile things that people will still say. Okay? Is that what you... And then now, when... And then when... So, what is it... You know, the conclusions from this are going to be tough. You know, should the rebellious woman be put in charge of the education program for the lay ministers? Should... Who, you know, you get into the questions that the casuists dealt with. I mean, you know, should we be the fellow that does abortions in one hospital be running your gynecology in the Catholic and just say, oh, no, I don't do any abortions? You run into a, I made a brief reference to the doctrine of the interconnectedness and equality of the virtues. That's another discussion, too. But, you know, they all come together. You can't keep, the virtues grow like the fingers of the hand. You just can't lose one of them and have the other three. This is the anti-hero, you know, the prostitute with the heart of gold. you know, Brokeback Mountain. you know, that's the play, you know, these great guys. So, that does, the answer to your question is, of course, but you've got to move in gently. You know, you can't make, and you have to draw people to see that the grace is something which really transforms.
Quick question.
Sure.
St. Augustine wrote a tract called On Admonition and Grace, and in that it's acknowledged to be one of the greatest writings on grace itself. And in that tract, he was fighting against the quietism of the day and whether. It seems to me that there's a modern parallel in the quietism of the church with arity, but very rarely is truth plugged in there. And sometimes truth is the very sword which allows you to provide for the supernatural future of the person that you're dealing with. But we live in a culture where bishops are not signs of contradiction. They're floating along with all the cultural commitments of the day. And they just don't engage in a way that Christ himself was a sign of contradiction. Could you comment on that at all?
Well, you know, bishops have a lot to do. And it's not... So let's leave the bishops aside. I mean, we should do our own jobs. well. But the point you made, yes, St. Augustine, the text is not against the quietism, it's against the Donatists. I mean, it's, and then against the Pelagians, I mean, it's St. Augustine's battle. And But the point about truth is at the heart of the matter. Well, that's what prudence is. Faith and prudence. If I had, if you had the human person here, I mean, the virtues sanctify every part of us. The intellect, faith and prudence, the rational appetite, the will that we choose, justice and hope and charity, there's where agape comes. And then fortitude and temperance in the sense appetites. But all the virtues of the will, according to the classical understanding of these matters, only work to the extent that truth informs them. Yeah. And now, to be honest with you, certain interpreters of St. Augustine would argue that the heart has the priority. And there is a strain of quietism, it's called Jansenism, that comes out of St. Augustine. I mean, the classical 17th century French quietism arguably appeals to St. Augustine, in his anti-Pelagian tracts. But that's an unjustifiable appeal. Here, I mean, the problem with St. Augustine and the virtues is that he's the source and teacher for all of the people who up to the 12th century thought that the only virtue that existed was Christian virtue. See, that the advantage to Aquinas is that he's ready to entertain the question, which I don't discuss in this paper, about what kind of virtue can exist outside of grace. And that's revolutionary, and he does it because of Aristotle, and he does it because he has a confidence in human nature, and he does it because he knows that original sin did not destroy nature. That's why Anders Nygren only thinks that charity is of any value, because he thinks original sin, as a good Lutheran, has destroyed nature. And that's a bad starting point. Now, St. Augustine did not think that original sin destroyed nature, although some people read him that way. But for Aquinas, it's very clear that what original sin introduces is a privation of original justice. What kept nature together, original sin removes. And nature, as it were, begins to fall apart on its own because its principles are unable to be stabilized. But they can be restabilized even by the acquired virtues. And it goes against all common sense to try to argue that there isn't such a thing as acquired virtue, because you've got all kinds of people that are running, building bridges and running businesses and doing all sorts of things. Some of them are getting caught and go to jail, that's true, but a lot of them don't. And life goes on. So to do a high profile Christological exclusivism, no Catholic can do it. And Benedict, that's why I studied those texts. Many people will think that he's heading in that direction, because his own formation, as he says when he was introduced into the Pontifical Academy of the Sciences, was biblical, ecumenical, and liturgical renewal. He was never trained in St. Thomas. But you can't be Catholic and not give nature its own intelligibility. And when you give nature its own intelligibility, you also give the priority to truth, because prudence can figure things out.
Time for one more.
On
Good Friday, yeah. Father Santa Messa gave an address to the Holy Father.
Right.
And before the end, he had a reflection on the encyclical. The half of the address. And he mentioned, he said that he had a quote from Kierkegaard, and he said he was the philosopher who wrote the best about love after Plato. And that was news to me. So that's a funny.
You know the joke, the thing among the things God doesn't know. You've heard that, but there are about seven things God doesn't know. One of them is what a Dominican has said when he gets out of the pulpit. Another is what a Franciscan is going to say when he gets in. That's two of the things God. So Father Cantalamessa is very Italianate. He succumbs to the enthusiasms of the moment. Well, thank you for your question.